Welcome to New Books in Language. Today I'm talking with Vashawn Young about the book Other People's English, Code Meshing, Code Switching and African American Literacy. It's a book that challenges the code switching approach to the teaching of so-called standard English and proposes and defends an alternative, code meshing. In this interview, we discuss some of the problems associated with code switching and the challenges and opportunities opened up by code meshing, as well as touching on some of the broader issues associated with African American language education. I'm delighted to welcome Vashawn Ashanti Young, a.k.a. Dr. Vey, the host of New Books in African American Studies, to talk about his new book, Other People's English, in which he and his co-authors advocate code meshing as an approach to language pedagogy. Vashawn, this is a co-written book, but I get the impression that your ideas are somewhat the catalyst for it. Would that be a fair assessment?
That is exactly right. The idea of code meshing, which is a neologism of mine that goes back to 2004, is the through line of the book.
And this is something which has been embraced by, you know, at least the co-authors, and I feel that they've really taken that idea on board and are applying it in a range of settings.
That's right. It might be actually appropriate to define what I mean by code meshing, because it is something that is relatively new, being something that's been used in the within the recent decade, I should say. But code meshing is an educational term in literacy studies that actually refers to what linguists mean by metaphorical code switching, which is to say this is the blending of two or more languages, language systems or dialects in one speech act. And that's what we mean by code meshing. So blending African American English with standard English, or African American English with academic discourse within one speech act or within one paper.
As you mentioned, the idea of code switching as defined in language pedagogy seems to be a rather narrower idea from what linguists or people in linguistics mean by code switching. Do you feel that something's kind of been lost, maybe accidentally or maybe even intentionally, in that transition between disciplines?
Definitely. It's interesting that you said that it might be intentionally, and I think so. But I think it's also unintentional. The intentionality of using code switching in a reductive manner in educational context stems from teachers thinking that it is best to educate African American students in ways that would help them keep their African American English separate from standard English. And in that sense, it's quite intentional to present code switching as leaving one dialect completely or one language system completely and taking on another without the interference or influence of that native or prior language system. So in that way, it is intentional, but in some ways it's unintentional. And I think in this way, I believe that teachers overall, educators in K-12 education in the U.S., do not have a wide grasp of linguistics. As a matter of fact, I don't even think they have a narrow grasp of linguistics. I think the linguistic education of teachers need to be expanded in the K-12 system. And so I think that when they hear code switching as posited as a pedagogy, that they unintentionally take it up as a linguistic pedagogy, because they're not really trained in linguistics, even in English language arts education or elementary education. Linguistics is probably a secondary, if not tertiary, study to their programs.
And the particular way in which you feel that the sort of richness of code switching from a linguistic point of view has been neglected is that the kind of code switching that is practiced in language pedagogy is something which you argue actually reinforces inequality of power and prestige and in some sense embraces that. Would that be a fair summary?
It would. As I understand it, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, being a linguist yourself, is that linguists, when they identify language systems, they don't posit one as being superior to the other, that all language systems or languages have the ability to communicate. They all have a range of registers, formal, informal, and middle range. And you can't say that that this language is somehow more effective than another language. However, code switching, as it is adopted and taught by educators, actually do, whether it's intentionally or not, posit one language as better than the other or more superior than the other in certain contexts. So in school context or professional context, teachers often say that standard English, quote unquote, is better or more superior, even if they don't use those terms, than African-American English. And it posits inequality of people who are associated with those language systems. So a number of linguists in the U.S. have theorized that standard English is based on the speech patterns and habits of middle and upper class Midwestern white people. And of course, it goes without saying that African-American English is based on the historical, cultural, linguistic patterns of black people, primarily in the U.S. And so when you say that in school or in one type of assignment that one English is better than the other, you're actually creating a hierarchy of languages.
It's interesting because it's, from a linguistic point of view, it's something that has historically happened, or at least it seems to be an error that people spontaneously fall into time and again, to assume that one language rather than another is the appropriate language for a particular function. But of course, from a linguistic point of view, it's not borne out except in, if you like, certain very marginal cases where a language doesn't have the vocabulary to deal with a particular area. In this case, we're dealing much more with differences in syntax and morphology, as I understand it.
Yes, I think so. But you might have to say a bit more about what you mean by syntax and morphology in this context, because I think that one of the things that I argue is that even on a morphological or syntactical level, that standard English can be blended with African-American English because the language systems overlap in so many ways.
Indeed, yes. And I mean, it's argued in the book, moreover, that African-American English has, in certain respects, more expressive power than standard English.
Exactly, yes. That's one of the interesting things about this debate, is that one of the consequences, one of the problematic, if you will, or deleterious consequences of code switching is that for African-Americans who do it in academic settings or in professional settings, we argue that they lose a kind of expressivity. They lose a kind of power and effectiveness that they would otherwise have if they were allowed to use African-American English in those contexts. We actually state this over and over again and have pointed to others, such as novelist Toni Morrison, who has said that disallowing African-Americans from not using African-American English actually is a cruel fallout of racism, that the language is much more expressive. And to say that a language that is less expressive, in this case standard English, which is less expressive than African-American English, is better, is not a result of effective communication, but a result of prejudice.
And you mentioned that it was while you were working as an English teacher that you started to become really aware of that issue, and your thinking developed around code switching versus code meshing. Can you reconstruct any of the sort of development of those ideas?
Well, as an African-American person myself, I thought that the best thing to do growing up was to do code switching. That is to say, to not use African-American rhetoric, use African-American speech styles and African-American grammar in public spaces. As a matter of fact, I thought that the people who used African-American English were ineffective communicators and in some ways bad people, even though I'm African-American myself. I held these problematic, prejudicial views. when I was an English teacher, I noticed that my students, when I taught African American students, were not eager to leave their African American English and to adopt code switching behaviors. But what was interesting is that those students who were eager to leave African American English and to gain a wider and greater facility in standard English, they themselves were unable to completely leave their African American English. And so I saw them struggle with trying to prevent themselves from using African American English, but time and time again, that influencing their writing. And in many ways, I thought that that influence was much more stronger, much more effective, and more interesting than in many ways the dull standard English they were trying to manufacture.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, it's obviously common ground to both sides in the debate, the, if you like, code switching versus code meshing, that ultimately it's, you know, very desirable to have people who are able to command a wide range of styles. Would it be right to say that there's a, if you like, a disagreement is about how you get there, whether in some sense what people are trying to do within the code switching paradigm is to get there via a route that's unnecessarily destructive or hostile or polarizing even within people as to how they feel about their own languages?
I don't think that most people who are code switching advocates, at least not the ones that I have read, the teachers or educational theorists who are code switching advocates, actually believe that they're helping students to develop a wide repertoire of styles that they can use effectively in any situation. I really don't. I think that what they are after is teaching students to use two different styles in different situations. And so that repertoire is not able to be used holistically in any one space. They have to be completely separate. And there's evidence to this effect in the book when we cite some of the theorists and work with some of their ideas that are unnecessarily restrictive. So both the process is restrictive and the end goal that they hope for is restrictive.
That's interesting because, as is discussed elsewhere in the book, it's not the case that people are able really to suppress their, if you like, native variety, regardless of what that variety is. It's, you know, you remark that among other cultures, among other groups, people are in fact borrowing informal English into their public pronouncements, into their academic writing or whatever, and not being sanctioned for it in the same way.
That's right, exactly. So we present in the book that when people from the dominant culture, that is to say more directly, when white people code mesh and borrow African American English in professional and school settings, they do not receive the same consequences that African Americans who are African American English speakers receive when they use African American English. And that's very problematic. That is also an evidence, we argue, of the prejudicial nature of this pedagogy, that it puts one people or group of people in a superior position. Whereas, and this isn't across the board, that isn't to say that, let's say, when someone uses Appalachian English or Southern English or other varieties that might be stigmatized as well, that they don't receive consequences. This is to say that when it comes to African American English and standard English users who are white, when they use African American English in certain settings, that they do not receive the consequences that African American English users receive. What's more is that at least the linguist who writes in the book, Rusty Barrett, has shown that people often mishear the language that people use when they are raced or gendered in a certain way. So sometimes even standard English users who are African American are often misheard as using African-American English when, in fact, they're using standard English. Now, the point of raising that is to point out that racism and prejudice have a lot to do with the way in which we receive and perceive people's language styles.
Is it the case, you think, that when people use the non-standard or perhaps I should say non-prestige variety, do you feel that the way in which people are treated reflects an attitude on the part of hearers toward the language or to the group to which they belong?
I believe it's intertwined, but I think it arises first and foremost from the group to which the language belongs. So African-American English is still stigmatized because African-American people have historically been oppressed and stigmatized. So I think they are responding to the group. And I think that example that I alluded to earlier, when people mishear the language style of African Americans, even when those individuals are speaking standard English, they're hearing a stigmatized version of language. They are responding to the group or to the racial identity of that speaker as opposed to the language of the speaker. But it also shows that there is an extension from that prejudice against the group to the language of that group as a representation or expression of their culture and identity.
Precisely, yes. I mean, it strikes me that it might be the case that, so to speak, people who already have sufficient power, in a sense, who already have sufficient clout in the system, can borrow as they please and, to some extent, confer prestige on their choices by the fact that they choose them.
Yes. But in this instance, we're speaking of individuals who are in a dominant or mainstream group, or do you believe that it's that even African Americans, middle class African Americans, so to speak, can do the same thing?
Well, I don't really have a view. I mean, I was going to ask you. Two examples of political uses are discussed in the book. One from Senator Chuck Grassley, another reference is made elsewhere to President Obama's speech patterns, his rhetorical choices to some extent. And I wonder whether you feel that the kind of latitude that gets extended to white people in positions of power does to some extent get extended to the president, at least by, if you like, mainstream society, obviously not by his most trenchant critics.
My first response would be to say no, that latitude is not extended. As a matter of fact, the book that I'm working on now analyzes the public's responses to Obama's language style and his speech habits. And it's very interesting, the responses that they have. I don't want to give too much away about that book, but I do want to say this. It's been said over and over again that when Obama speaks in standard English and uses a academic style, that he is not masculine enough, that he is representing in a feminized discourse. And this isn't said just by the lay public. This is an argument that's been made in Newsweek. It's been made in the Washington Post by certain columnists. And I actually analyze why they believe this about Obama's use of standard English and academic style. And what's really interesting about this, Chris, I want to point out, is that it presents a double bind for African Americans. On the one hand, African American men is the group that has in America the lowest school retention rate and the lowest literacy rates. And so Obama, as a African American male, represents at the highest level of literacy, and yet he gets routinely criticized. Either he is criticized for being too professorial, too elitist in his language style, too academic, or he's criticized for being not manly enough in his rhetorical style. So what does that do for African-American men for whom Obama is held out as a role model? It presents a dilemma. do they acquire the school literacy habits that are supposed to be held out for them to achieve the status that Obama has achieved, or do they resist it in order to resist these very narrow and problematic criticisms and characterizations of Obama's language style? So no, to answer that question more directly and succinctly, I do not think that the same latitude that was given to Grassley was given to Barack Obama or other African Americans for that matter.
No, it's a fair point. I hope you don't mind me asking. I mean, it's something that sort of struck me as maybe the ultimate demonstration of how far this prejudice is going to extend, so to speak, would be that if people find that their president is not speaking in a manner that is becoming, because even his prestige as an individual is not sufficient to license these usages.
I agree. Even though he uses African American English all the time, but it's often ignored, and there are reasons for that. Another linguist who I read a lot and admire, Rosina Lippi Green, in her book English with an Accent: Language and Discrimination in the U.S., actually analyzes the 2008 campaign strategies of the Republicans and analyzes some of the revealed memos about how to profile Barack Obama as elitist and so forth, and why his African-American English is often ignored because it goes against the elitist profile that was part of this, which was part of the counter strategy, even though he uses African-American English often. But on the other hand, Michelle Obama, as a frequent user of African-American English in public, hers has been presented more publicly and more frequently. But what has happened is, and this was in the first campaign and a little bit in the second campaign, in the 2012 campaign, is that she was profiled as the angry black woman. And her discursive style was used as evidence of that.
Yes, I think it's a rather dispiriting story one way or another. I won't make you spill the entire contents of your next book, because there's so much more to say about this. I mean, it seemed to me, for one thing, that the arguments that you're putting forward for code meshing as a strategy apply, well, not only to black English in the US, but also to any situation in which different varieties of language, particularly ones where there are different power associations and different prestige associations, come into contact. And indeed, Xandi Young Rivera exemplifies the method in a bilingual English-Spanish classroom. How general do you see the approach as being?
I think that it's very general, because we're talking about a linguistic fact of life. What the educators have done, who have adopted this the limited or reductive sense of code switching according to context and changing your language, is that's not a linguistic fact of life. The linguistic fact of life is that many people who encounter or who are influenced by multiple languages or multiple varieties of one language, such as multiple varieties of English, use those varieties simultaneously all the time. To imagine that this language does not affect the English usage of the English speakers is very problematic, and it's just actually untrue, just on a human level. And so I think it applies very broadly across languages and across groups of people. Now, my own research and interests happens to be solely on African Americans in the U.S. And so I tend to stick with that group. But the linguist in the book, Rusty Barrett, does talk about other peoples and other languages. And my colleague, Suresh Kanagaraja, who theorizes code meshing among multilinguals, argue something similar. And so if people are interested in how code meshing is theorized and observed among multilinguals and how it could actually help us understand the language habits of Americans, I would actually send them to Suresh Kanagaraj's work, especially one of his essays on code meshing teachable strategies. And that is purely in a multilingual context.
I was going to say that, I mean, a general analogy kind of suggests itself between code meshing in the classroom and bilingual education in general, which has also been argued to have both obvious and non-obvious advantages and also to present certain challenges and require a degree of commitment from all concerned. Is that a kind of analogy you would encourage?
I would, and here's why. Recently, I was asked to review a couple of research articles that dealt with bilingual education and code switching in a non-U.S. context. This was education that was going on in other countries. And what was revealed in at least one of the studies that I read was that allowing students to do something like what I've been calling code meshing actually facilitates their growth in English acquisition much more than if they were asked to leave them or to not code mesh, to actually just learn English outside or in isolation of their native language. And I was very taken by that study. It seemed to be very well done, and it was not just that I agreed with it, but it was a longitudinal study done over a period of years that actually yielded the results that the best way to teach multiple languages is not to keep them separate, but to allow them to commingle.
I guess the analogy might meet with some resistance or attract controversy on if the controversy about African American English as a language versus a dialect versus variety, etc., is in any sense still a live issue. Do you feel that people will take more persuading of the analogy with bilingual education, or that the evidence from the advantages of bilingualism would help to underscore the point of teaching code meshing?
Well, I think that your question raises an interesting problem, actually, for code meshing advocates, because of the history of the debate of African American English, whether it's a dialect, whether it's a variety, whether it's a language, et cetera, and whether or not it can stand on par analogously with other confirmed languages. Here's what we say in the book. We say that African American vernacular, Black English, Ebonics, African American language, and African American English all refer to about the same thing: the ways in which African American English speakers communicate and the observable patterns of this language in America. And so we sort of stay away from the debate and accept it as true that African American English is a language and it is also a variety of English.
I suppose my question is in some sense political in nature. Do you feel that there are disadvantages to taking a firm or defending a firm position on that in terms of the very sort of practical goal of getting your proposal taken seriously by the people who would actually be able to implement it at the chalk face?
But I guess I don't see what the consequences are that are implied in your question. Like, what are the consequences if they didn't take it seriously, and why wouldn't they?
No, I really wondered whether you felt that was whether in some sense to position this as an instance of bilingual education and appeal to that sort of parallel literature and explore those possible benefits, things like, you know, executive function and so on.
I understand. Yes, I understand your question, and it's a tough one, because in some senses to argue or say that teaching African American English is synonymous with bilingual education and that it's a separate language from English, in my particular version of the argument, could be problematic, because I'm saying that it is that the two varieties are not mutually exclusive, that we exaggerate the difference between African-American English and standard English. And so in that sense, you know, people could argue that if they're not distinct languages and they're not as different as we would see perhaps Spanish and German as being, then how could you argue for blending them? Because we don't argue for blending, say, a lot of another language, Portuguese, for instance, with English, and then turning that in as a paper or using that in public spaces that are primarily governed by the use of English. So in that sense, yes. But in another sense, absolutely not. And there are two reasons for it. One is that even if African American English is its own language system, own language and variety distinct from standard English, they can still be compatible. They can still have similar structural similarities, et cetera. We often think about, in this regard, Italian and Spanish, for instance. And I remember when I learned Spanish, it was really easy for me to pick up on Italian because of the similarities in the language. They're not completely the same, but there is a lot of overlap. And I sort of think about, in a bilingual sense, standard English and African-American English as operating along the same paradigm. But then there's one more thing to point out. The research is growing on the mutuality between languages and the ways in which multilinguals communicate with one another. So we often think of bilingual education as people who are learning to change according to context, again, like code switching. So I'm going to use one language here and I'm going to learn another particularly distinct language to use in other settings. But the emerging research on multilingual communication is how different language systems and terms, ideas, vocabularies often intermix among multilinguals, that the idea of take up is much more effective when talking about multilingual discourse than error, for instance. So if a group of multilinguals are having a conversation and one of them uses a term or a word or something from a specific language that is not taken up by the others in the group, then that is an instance of what we might think of as error, but not error in the sense that it's wrong, but just in the fact that it wasn't taken up. And that doesn't mean that what wasn't taken up won't be taken up later. You know, it's just dropped for the moment or in this particular communicative act. And I think that that's much more of a resilient theorization of the way in which communication happens across languages. And so in that sense, when we think about pushing the paradigm of bilingual education, maybe we should think of it instead as multilingual education instead of just two.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it strikes me a related point is that, as is I think also discussed at various points in the book, there is this high level of mutual comprehensibility, not least because the mainstream culture has so much influence from African-American English in it that, to a large extent, and particularly in a broad international context, it is inevitably going to influence the standard language and, in some sense, arrive in the prestige form by stealth, if not for the necessarily for the benefit of the people who speak it.
Absolutely, absolutely. And as a matter of fact, even though when I have conversations with people, I often refer to my understanding of sociolinguistics. I should definitely say I'm not a linguist and I'm not a sociolinguist either. I read in those areas for the purposes of making this argument and understanding the function of language, but it's not an area of training. What is an area of training of mine is on race and race relations. And so when we talk about the ways in which the language of a oppressed people, African-American English, for instance, even though it is broadly a part of standard English, I have to ask the question as a African-American studies scholar, why is it that those features of African-American English and its influence of standard English is not broadly recognized or accepted or praised, when in fact African-American English rhetorically helps the effectivity of standard English? So because we have a narrow version of standard English in our idealized sense of the term that excludes the influence of African-American English and other varieties of English as well, it presents a problematic, narrow, prescriptive version of that language system.
I guess a point that you make on that is that to some extent, the perception of African-American English is that it gets compartmentalized and treated or acknowledged as being suitable for particular purposes, like, for example, in music, and yet doesn't get used in, so to speak, serious discourse, because people have been trained in this pure code-switching paradigm and tend not to, with a few pretty notable exceptions, tend not to mesh.
That's where they tend not to acknowledge that they're meshing, or they tend to try to reduce the meshing. But I think that it goes back to slavery, to be quite honest with you, where African Americans or enslaved Africans at the time could be entertainers on the plantation. They could communicate in service roles, but they were not seen as equal. I think those ideas sustain or remain today, that entertainment, music, even comedy, et cetera, where you hear a number of African-American English users in the public sphere, but they're, even if they earn high salaries, they are still in a kind of quote-unquote service position to make the mainstream laugh or to entertain. But the serious domains of formal writing, journalism, etc., it is argued by educators that those spaces do not accommodate African-American English. But in fact, they do, as I point out in the book and show examples of where this actually happens quite routinely, more routinely than we want to give credit to or acknowledge, that African-American English is part of the growing culture of literacy in America and is often used to compose in very very serious prose. So it's not entirely true that it's just a few isolated cases where African American English is used in these serious spaces. It's actually more widely used than we recognize.
That gives me a chance to ask a question which I wanted to about the if you like the domain of that code meshing, which is that, well, you and many other scholars in African American studies are pushing code meshing very firmly into the academic domain. Do you feel it's the case that there are expectations about which topics within academia you can write about in that way? Do you feel it's the case that people in, for argument's sake, hard sciences are reluctant to use the kind of informality that might actually be expected elsewhere?
That's a great question. I mean, that's an awesome question, because it might seem to be that academics in the humanities, for instance, in English or rhetoric or even education as a social science would find more acceptability in using African-American English or in code meshing, as opposed to someone in the fields of biology or chemistry or math. That's beyond the scope of what I've studied so far, but I do want to point out two things that are suggestive of a response. One is that I have read others who have studied the writing of people in formal formal settings. For example, one study observed the writing of a police officer who was writing very formal police reports. And he often used his own style. He often used African-American English. And when asked why he did that, he said because it sounded better. And his reports were not sent back to him. He was not asked to revise. He was a very successful person at his job and highly liked and praised. That's one example that shows that it's not restrictive to creative endeavors in certain humanistic fields. But another one is a study that I did in my classroom. I had the students in a writing class to study the informal, formal, and middle register communications, both written and spoken, of an employer or a professional in the area in which they intended to go. So nurses, students who were studying nursing would study nurses and their communication at work, doctors, health, other health areas, and health was one of the biggest areas in this class, but also in other areas. And what we found overall, and this was a very informal study, it hasn't been written up, it's just something that I did in my class a couple of times, but what we found in all of the classes is that the ideas and perceptions that we went into, took into the interviews with the professionals were not the kinds of communications that they actually employed in their offices, that it was much more informal, even when the communication genre itself or mode was thought to be or framed as being formal. It was much more informal, and they used many, many styles of communication in one email or inter-office memo or even a intra-office communication. So while there may be reluctance, there is also evidence to suggest that code meshing is a more widely and broadly deployed communication activity.
That's some fascinating work. I mean, it struck me that, so to speak, the argument against code meshing in a biology paper in Nature was going to be, we can't do that because this has strict genre rules, and the argument for would be, well, actually, everybody is doing it anyway, they just don't acknowledge it.
Right.
Which I suspect is the case for a lot of
right.
readable writing. I want to turn in the last portion of this interview to some of the practicalities of the method. A particular challenge which Kim Brown Lovejoy discusses in his chapters of the book is maybe how to teach something that's potentially beyond the teacher's capability. In this case, sort of encouraging students to use communicative resources that the teacher doesn't necessarily command. I wonder, do you see that as a real challenge that needs to be confronted, or do you feel it's more a matter of people being in their comfort zone to some extent when teaching in the current pedagogies?
I think that it is a challenge, but I think that it should be viewed as a welcomed challenge, that teachers should embrace the opportunities to become more familiar with the linguistic repertoires of their students and of themselves. I have been an English teacher for a long time. I trained as a high school English teacher some 18 years ago. And when I taught high school, it didn't just come trippingly off the tongue, and that's not just because I'm African-American and have African-American English in my background. That's because no English teacher that I know of can just teach the language without reference to some academic material, without a textbook, without reminders of what an object pronoun is or subject pronoun and whether one can be the subject of a sentence or not. That these things we do remember, but we often need refreshers, reminders, et cetera. So teaching is not a static activity. And I say that somewhat emphatically because the same holds true for becoming acquainted with understanding, learning about, and refreshing our notions about what other varieties of Englishes are, African-American English as well. So for a teacher to say that's not my background or I don't have a linguistic facility is in some ways a cop-out. And I think that Kim Lovejoy is a perfect example of this. He's a white guy, but he doesn't shy away from teaching African-American rhetoric and African-American rhetorical styles. And while some of those styles are not native to his own language and that he would not probably ever use, he doesn't say that I'm not going to ever use it. It's always a possibility that these can become a part of his discursive styles as well. And that's something that I think teachers who are interested in adopting the pedagogy and also the ideology should embrace.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely my impression from what's said elsewhere in the book that there's work to be done in broadening the understanding of the rules of African-American English. I mean, right at the beginning of the book, Rusty Barrett gives this example where he cites instances from Catherine Stockett's book, The Help, which garnered acclaim for its portrayal of African-American English, but is actually wrong in the sense of failing to abide by the grammatical system of that language.
Right.
So obviously it's quite a challenge even for literary critics to know whether somebody who claims to be writing in a different variety is actually getting it right, even in an appropriately relative sense.
That's right. And that's one of my favorite examples in the book, because he phrases it in a very interesting way to say, how is it that a white female who gets African-American English wrong gets praised for it, but an African-American who uses African-American English correctly gets criticized for it. I think that's an awesome way to present the paradox that we're talking about. You're pointing out that example in connection with what we had just previously talked about. It's interesting because Rusty Barrett himself is white from the rural working class, but yet is the linguist that's pointing out the patterns of African-American English and has a depth of knowledge in it. So it's not African-American English and knowledge of it is not essentialized to one group of people, that, you know, it can be understood by multiple groups and even used by people who are not African-American.
And increasingly is. But I guess from an academic point of view, it's something that people are going to need to work on to take full advantage of the opportunities that you're describing.
Right. Exactly.
On a practical note, what would you like to see happen as a consequence of this book being out there?
There are two things that I would like to see. I think that more work needs to be done in classrooms on code meshing. That is to say, there needs to be more evidence, more explicit evidence of teachers consciously learning about and understanding and using the rhetorical power of African-American English in standard English context. That is one thing that I definitely would like to see. The other thing I would like to see is a reduction in the prejudice against African-American English and African-Americans. That reduction in prejudice would mean to me that African-American English users in the public sphere, in professional settings and in academic settings would not be stigmatized, and those people would not face consequences for using that language variety.
Is your work going forward focusing in support of those goals, or do your immediate research priorities take you elsewhere?
My immediate research dovetail on the idea of code switching, but actually how it affects African-American men from a gender perspective. So in the book that I referenced earlier that I'm working on, I only mention code switching in the chapter in which I'm talking about Barack Obama, but I enlarge it beyond grammatical features, and it's more in the realm of rhetoric and how the rhetorical use of African-American English is actually a gendering mechanism for black men. But that said, I am working on developing a more large-scale, somewhat social scientific study of multilingual users of code meshing. And I want to study both in speaking and writing how multilinguals use code meshing and whether or not it facilitates the goals of university learning better than code switching or isolated training in just strict standard English, or what we understand as the English language. So that is a large scale study that I have not embarked upon, because I'm creating a team of individuals to help design the study and then to execute it. And it will be a longitudinal study over the course of a couple of years.
It sounds like a very exciting project. I get the impression I'm probably guilty of underselling the book as it stands as a resource and as an inspiration for actual teaching planning, because there are your co-authors are embracing these ideas and you're pushing them forward and putting them into practice. I think particularly your sister is that, not so?
That's right. That's right. But you are correct also in that the book is largely ideological. Those chapters on pedagogy are serving the ends of saying primarily that code meshing is valuable, is viable, it should not be restricted. Even the college teaching section, which looks at Kim Bryan's classrooms, they're not templates for what to do in a classroom, but they are models of what has been done using code meshing. And they're supposed to sort of persuade individuals that, yes, I can do this in my classroom.
Well, I hope that I hope people will suitably be persuaded, because I'd be very interested to see the effect of this over a much wider domain of application. I have to close now. Thank you so much for your time and for sharing with us those very interesting ideas.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. Thank you, Chris.
I've been talking with Vashaun Young about Other People's English, Code Meshing, Code Switching, and African American Literacy. This is Chris Cummins for New Books in Language, saying thank you for listening.